So today we are joined by economic analyst, author, researcher, John Snyson. You can find John's work on World Alternative Media, where himself and Josh Sigerson have really built up quite the impressive following. They've been growing like absolutely crazy, especially the past few weeks. I mean, just 2 weeks ago, I don't want to say you only had, you know, 92,000 people following you, but now it's like 101 just in this. And I think at one point you crossed 100, then they, you know, eliminated a bunch of people. Then they, so you guys actually got the pleasure of breaking 100,000 twice all in this week. So it's sort of funny how that goes on. But you guys have just been pumping out tons and tons of content. And, you know, it's really actually quite amazing the amount of content that's been coming out. And especially since, you know, you are, you know, editing the videos in-house, and mainly Josh is editing those. Commendable. But, you know, one of the reasons why I wanted to bring John on the program was because he's one of the few economic analysts that A, actually understands what's actually going on, and B, didn't capitulate in the face of everyone telling us this is the greatest economy in the history of the world. I also want to point out today that Josh is coming to us from Canada, and it's not just an American situation that's going on. We really have a global, worldwide slowdown that is upon us. And probably a good place to start might actually be to talk about what's going on in Canada, because myself, like most ignorant Americans, we don't pay attention as much to our neighbors up north. And I know that you got all sorts of, you know, problems with heavy reliance on oil and fracking that's going on, and also reliance on, you've got all the overseas buyers from, you know, the Chinese coming into Vancouver, and the real estate just going through the roof to the point where it's obviously an unsustainable situation that's going on there. And a few years ago, one of my best friends asked me, he's like, what do you think one of the best investments are? And I'm like, well, I think everything's a bubble, but maybe betting against Canadian housing. And he's like, betting against Canadian housing. And this is like such a weird thing to talk about. And then Deutsche Bank was another one, I thought. And now we're finally starting to see some capitulation over there, but it's because of massive fraud that's going on, which I wasn't even really banking on. But first off, you know, I want to welcome you to the program, and just want to see kind of what's your take on what's going on in the global economy in Canada.
Thank you, sir. It's a pleasure to be on your show, Tim. And things are happening here in Canada. It's not only Canada, it's worldwide. I actually wrote a book on the Canadian economy back in 2014-15 about what I saw as the biggest issue that Canada will face in a very short period of time, I said. And that was the debt. It was the massive amount of debt that Canada was accumulating at the time. And sure enough, we're about 3 years later now, and we're seeing Toronto, Vancouver really struggling their housing markets. So Toronto housing market is down. The Vancouver housing market was down. Then they implemented more government regulation in order to try to fix the housing bubble. Yeah, fix it, right? And then, of course, it came slightly back up again. So it's been a big yo-yo going on in Canada. I personally live pretty close to Winnipeg, Manitoba, which is kind of one of the slower places in Canada, where it's been like a steady growth for over 30 years. Nobody believed that we're going to see a housing crash here at all, but we're still seeing high prices. So we're seeing houses that are, I would say the average, how much it's risen, is probably about 30-40% over the last 5 or 6 years or so here. So we're seeing it here as well, here in Winnipeg, Manitoba, which is one of the slower places in Canada. We're still seeing mass accumulation of debt here. Manitoba, where I live, is one of the most credit card indebted populace in Canada, and we're seeing the average private debt to GDP, I think, I don't have the number off of my head, but I think it's 280 something of GDP, which is completely insane. We're looking at three times. But you know what's funny though, Tim, is
that sounds sustainable. That sounds like it can keep going on forever.
Oh yeah, just keep it going. You know, go to a 6 times, 10 times GDP. That's totally fine. We could just keep on printing money until all assets are, you know, at hyper values, and you just keep on printing, nothing will happen. There's going to be nobody suddenly that's going to say, well, this Canadian dollar or US dollar or whatever currency we have is kind of worthless, like it's not buying me as much anymore, because, you know, wages and everything else hasn't kept up with the massive rise in house prices and all the other costs that we have to implement. So it's just a huge balance game these Keynesians are playing, you know, printing money and then trying to, you know, race, minimum wage, all this fun stuff that they're trying to do. Just like in Venezuela, where they raised it, you know, 3,000% or something just recently. it won't fix anything. That's the problem. We're over-accumulating debt. Canada is really suffering. You know, not only the debt, but we're suffering because the commodity prices are substantially down. Look at the oil prices, you know, from the heights of about 120. The Canadian actually crude from the tar sands in Alberta. I don't know if you paid attention to that, but recently it was all the way down at $10 a barrel. $10 a barrel because the pipelines are getting canceled. There's nowhere to transport the oil and it's all landlocked. So it's not, you know, available easily for transportation anywhere. So they're really struggling. They actually had to, the government actually came in and thinking that they're going to save the economy. They went in and limited the actual production of the oil in the tar sands. That helped it up to about 25, I think it sits at right now. And, you know, things are really hitting the fan. You're having the federal government went and bought the Kinder Morgan pipeline that's going, that was supposed to go from Alberta to BC. It's not getting built. So all these government interventions are happening. And just recently, actually, the Canadian government bailed out $1.6 billion, the Alberta government, the Alberta economy, in order to try to save, you know, from utter disaster. It's funny, though, what happened after the oil prices really dropped after 2008 crash. They started to really struggle in Alberta because they're a one-trick pony kind of economy where they only really, the one big dependence that they have is the oil industry, and you see real estate prices fluctuates with that. But in Alberta, what was interesting is they have, you know, substantial amount of suffering because of that. But then they got what's called a National Democratic Party elected. And Premier Notley, which is her name, she actually came in when there were the economy is really suffering. She came in and raised taxes and pushed in a whole bunch of more government fees and regulation on top of, you know, a suffering economy, which is you should do the complete opposite. You should limit government and you should really free the markets as much as possible. But no, they came in and just like when, you know, the person was just about to, you know, come up out of the water for one last gasp, they just shove their head down again into the water. It's pretty insane behavior, but that's what it is over here in Canada. And the government intervention is just getting worse and worse, and we're seeing it on both sides, you know, both the left and the right. I call them both left on the political spectrum because they're not none of them are really, you know, right wing, which is more towards like the constitutionalist, libertarian, and anarchist, or what do you call the classical liberals? But yeah, so yeah, I'll let you get a word in here and let us see where we're gonna go for it. But that's Canada, though. It's not a very a good place to be right now. And with all the debt, you know, people are really starting to suffer, and the government is just constantly, and the central bank is just constantly buying up assets, trying to, you know, save the economy, but it's not happening. You know, according to me, I really see the economy going down a lot further from here.
No, you certainly gave us a lot to chew on with all that. Yeah. I mean, who better to ask what's going on with the Canadian economy than John Snyson? I love how you mentioned the National Democratic Party. It's like, oh no, we're not the Democratic Party. We're not like the National we're not the Democratic Socialist. Now we're the National Democratic Party.
Yeah,
all these names, and really, you know, everyone is fighting over, you know, this piece of real estate that is, you know, the Republicans, you know, might as well be the Democrats, and then the Democrats are basically the communists, and then if you then try to then, and it's so frustrating for somebody like me who, you know, I mean, basically, you know, kind of my like the quick version of my story is I created a Facebook page August 27th, 2016 because I was really pissed at the Libertarian Party. I used to call myself the Libertarian Advisor, and actually the back of this mic is my old logo and everything. And it was after Bill Weld of the Libertarian Party started talking about, he's like, you know what? He's like, you're right. AR-15s are dangerous, but actually handguns are even more dangerous, and we need to only have like 7 bullets. And I'm like, this is coming from the vice presidential candidate of the Libertarian Party. And so I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to try to do everything I can to defeat Hillary Clinton. But I thought, I'm like, you know what? Trump does, let's say, 1,000 things, and he does 999 things that are great, but he does not address the problem of the monetary system of the Federal Reserve, that the fact we have debt-based debt-based monetary system. I don't care about the other 999 because all we did was just buy ourselves another 4 years. Maybe we bought ourselves 8 years. And I thought that if everything were to collapse underneath Hillary, that America would be remade in the image of basically whatever they wanted to remake it in, and it wouldn't be something you and I or anybody would really, I mean, Josh probably wouldn't want to be living here if, you know, underneath that type of, I mean, it'd probably be a lot going on to report. But it's just absolutely crazy to see this, you know, pushback where people like myself have been called, you know, effing liberals for, you know, daring criticize anything that Trump does, even though it's the people that aren't, like, it's like almost like they've walked into this trap of seeing, of like, oh, this is the best economy in the history of the world, when really it was juiced up. And Obama had, you know, basically the neck, you know, his boot down on the neck. And yeah, we released it for a tiny bit. But ultimately, if the money is backed by debt, you can't get your way out of a debt problem when the money is backed by debt to begin with. And so it's just, so you also mentioned Keynesian economics. And really, that's the problem, is that we've got Keynesian leftists versus Keynesian Republicans. And you can't out, you know, they're trying to out Keynesian each other, and the Republicans are never going to be as good as, you know, giving away stuff. You know, it's Christmas time, you know, the Democratic Party, you know, Bernie Sanders' platform is basically, you know, the platform of being Santa Claus, and anyone can be, you know, Santa Claus, but, you know, eventually, you know, you got to pay the piper. And one thing that I think that I'm really trying to get out over here is you were recently at G. Edwards, you know, private residence for a conference they had out there. And really a lot of this knowledge that we have, it kind of traces back to G. Edwards, and he stands on the shoulders of other people as well. And at the end of the day, you know, the guy who created the Federal Reserve System, Paul Warburg, who was based off, you know, Daddy Warbucks from the play Annie, you know, he said we shall have a one world government. It's only a matter if it's through consent or conquest. And to see people just begging for this, you know, their own enslavement, it's just terrible. And I think it could go into where people beg to have like a government crypto. And now we've got like the mark of the beast crypto that people were asking for. And so it's nice to see you guys reporting on all the things that are going on. But, you know, I guess pivoting to Australia, I mean, Australia is probably not too much better from a housing outlook. You know, you take a look at like the percentages of income it takes to, you know, own just a small piece of property out there. And it seems like basically they're in the same situation as like Vancouver or some of the larger cities out there in Canada. And I'm sure they might be doing some things. I don't really know probably as much as you, so I'll shut up now and try to get the digest on what's going on in Australia.
Well, you know, it's funny. I actually did a report on Australia recently because I was doing a bigger report. I was downloading all the information from Bancor International Settlements and all the debt in the world. And from doing that, I found out a lot about different countries. And I was like, hey, look at Australia over here. Australia is currently actually having a downturn in the economy. They're having housing prices have collapsed between 10 to 15%, depending on where you live. Some are up, like Tasmania is still up. I talked to locals there, but they are worried now. Some people are approaching me about, you know, should I sell my house? Like it's gone up 35% over the last 2 years. It's pretty unsustainable, you know, levels of increase in an asset, which actually the asset of a house is not really an asset until you actually make money off of it. You know, it's Robert Kiyosaki. I'm pretty sure you're familiar with him. You know, your house is not an asset until it actually makes you money back into your pocket. If you pay money out of your pocket, your house is not an asset. Maybe if you sell it for a huge profit or a profit, it definitely is an asset. But until that time, it's definitely a liability on your balance sheet. But what's happening in Australia is that the interest rates have stayed flat for very long. They're about 1% or so, 1.25, I believe, that the Reserve Bank of Australia has the interest rate at. What's interesting, though, is that they are having collapsing house prices even before they started to raise interest rates. In Canada, the trigger was the raising of interest rates. They are having a collapse of 10 to 15% in some of the major cities of their housing markets while they're actually seeing the central bank is having it, you know, have had it at the level for like the last 5 years or so, a low level. And now they're talking about doing quantitative easing, the Reserve Bank of Australia, and doing more lowering of interest rates in order to save the economy, because their housing market is really collapsing on most fronts. There's, of course, pockets everywhere. If you look into real estate, there's certain, you know, places even within cities that you could make money if you know what you're doing, but you really got to study and understand real estate on what approach you need to take as real estate investing if you are going to sustain yourself in certain markets, because there is always, you know, money to make. Like, I have a lot of friends that are very successful real estate investors, but they're not the blindsided ones. They actually gone through crises. So they understand, you know, what approaches to take at what given time in a market when it's really struggling. You might go and move into, for example, when the baby boomers are having their markets are selling, you know, today they're the demographics of the baby boomers are going down. So they're selling a lot of assets. They are moving into smaller condos, for example, they're downsizing. So that's a place to go for investors, for example, from that. But yeah, Australia is really struggling. And I did a lot of more research on Australia, and I have a full report, about 50 pages report on Australia.
That's it. That's it. Only 50 pages for us.
No. Yeah, there's 50 pages, but I actually went through the whole economy. I went from everything from real estate to commodities to their stock markets, everything. I tried to get everything for the common man out there to understand it, not for, you know, the actual avid investors. I'm trying to more like my approach, because I'm not, you know, a huge guy in the investment field. I have been involved somewhat in doing the real estate investments here in Canada, but I haven't, you know, have my background is not fully in the investment world. Only the last 10 years I've been involved quite a bit, but I wouldn't call myself like an expert, like you're allowed to actually give advice that if you're actually regulated under securities and exchange commissions in your country. But I do see a lot of huge issues in the Australian economy. You know what's funny, Tim? Everywhere they have the same issues with mass amounts of debt that have accumulated because of super low interest rates. People are just doing stupid mistakes, borrowing way too much money on what they should have, and investing it in a lot of bad investments, either it's real estate, business, stocks, whatever it is. People are just piling in because they're seeing that, oh, stock markets and everything is going up. Meanwhile, it's actually the central bank that did that. They lowered interest rates. So they fueled, you know, they knew that they could fuel the margin debt in the stock markets to have people push up the stock prices, and then the cheap real estate loans to the populace and to investors to go and invest money. And that's been, you know, the case all over across the world. Norway, where I'm from, that's where I originally grew up. Norway is in a huge, massive bubble as well when it comes to their real estate. The UK, Hong Kong is crashing right now. So all of these different places around the world having the same disease, and it's caused by the Federal Reserve System, which have, you know, grown up everywhere in the world. And yeah, they literally have destroyed the world with mass amounts of this cheap money. I call it raw sewage that are floating around the world that are just making everything stink up, really. If you know what you're smelling for, you can understand and find like how bad all this debt is for the economy. And it's not, you know, beneficial. Like we're just creating a massive bubble of epic proportions. And the problem is when you print so much money, at one point that inflate, like that money is, people are going to start taking profit. And that's what you kind of see now, where you have actually inflation starting to really trickle into the economy from all this printed money. And you're really starting to see the effects on the economies, and people have had stagnant wages. So everybody is seeing all these higher prices for all the assets and every old commodities that they need to buy for their daily survival. But now you've seen for example, in France, a carbon tax was the trigger for a huge riot. And it's continuing to go on because people are mad, not only on the government that they're saying that the problem was the carbon tax, that was the only thing. No, it's like all of the mass amounts of taxes. It's all the cheap money that are creating so much inflation in housing markets. People can't afford living anymore. And that is the biggest problem. It's the monetary system, as we were talking about first in the interview when you kind of introduced me. It's the monetary system that's the underlying issue here. And they need to print more and more money in order to sustain the continuing inflation, in order to make the debt cheaper and cheaper over time and pay off all the interest that doesn't exist when you print that money. So you're just getting a really like an exponential debt curve. And that's what we're seeing right now. That's what we're hitting. In order to sustain ourselves, we need to print mass amounts of more debt into the economy. And if we even get like slight deflation, that's what when, you know, Ben Bernanke and others will panic and say, we need to buy everything. You know, let's go and buy stocks like Bank of Japan and real, they bought stocks, real estate, ETFs. They own 86.11% of all the ETFs in Japan. It's completely ridiculous, Tim. But this is the symptom that we're seeing everywhere. But we don't understand the underlying issue, which is the monetary system that are fueling all of these underlying problems.
And that's why I like to have you on, because you basically said a lot of the stuff that I would say, and I don't have to say it. So you saved me, saved my throat. But you did mention demographics, and at least in America right now, we've got, you know, the average baby boomer didn't really start. You know, if you take a look when the baby boom went from, I believe it started in 1946, the average person spends the most amount of money in their lifetime at age 46. These are some studies that Harry Dent did in his book. Yeah. I believe it was called like Demographic Cliff, or I forgot what it was. I think it was called that. Yep. But anyways, you know, in 2008, the baby boomers were just starting to turn 62. Now it's 10 years later, and in America, those baby boomers are now 72. So at 62 years old, they were not forced to actually liquidate their assets, because a lot of them weren't planning to retire until a few years later anyways. Well, now they're actually being forced to liquidate assets once you're over the age of 70 and a half. And then they realize, oh, well, this, you know, 4,000 square foot house I'm in, you know, I should probably downside that as well. And there's people who, I mean, I'm in one of the epicenters of the real estate collapse in Phoenix, but guess what? I moved here after the collapse, and people in New York were like, oh, what an idiot, you know, redneck moving to Arizona. Like, don't you realize everything collapsed? I'm like, well, yeah, that's the best time to come in and buy.
Exactly.
And then recently I'm actually coming to you now from a rental home, because I sold the home for about 1,000% gain on my initial down deposit. And it was around the same time I was thinking about investing in the Bitcoin. And so I probably would have been about the same either way, whether I, you know, had the Bitcoin but I got, you know, got to live for free basically. Then when the company I was with decided that they would shut me down for speaking at Anarchapoco last year, I had to use that gain to basically build this business over here. So you've mentioned that, you know, people that are regulated by securities advice. So I am actually regulated by securities advice. So this is not financial advice. This is for informational purposes only.
Exactly.
But when you're talking, I pulled up a chart of the different central bank asset printing. It was not the most updated chart, but I mean, you get the picture of what's going on. I'm trying to find that again. So we've got what's going on. What really kind of, you know, messed up my entire thesis is, you know, when the Fed Reserve was, I believe it was right around, you know, right towards like the end of October 2014, they were going to stop printing money. And I thought, okay, well, this is it. This is like the moment I've been waiting for, when they're finally getting off the drugs, you know. And as you were alluding to, I mean, they need more and more QE. It's like a drug addict needs more and more drugs to get the high. They need more and more, you know, alcohol to get the buzz. And right now we're at the point where, you know, any more alcohol could, you know, kill us. And the fact that the central banks around the world have to capitulate to actually raising rates, you know, they're way behind the times over here. And, you know, and what happened, you just, you know, hit the nail on the head. And I've done several podcasts and client videos where I, you know, I type on the keyboard and say, hey, you know, the Federal Reserve, you know, the Bank of Japan is buying up all the stocks. And so it's creating an artificial situation where they're printing money out of thin air that never existed. And then now they buy up the stocks, which then creates this whole artificial paradigm. And so people that are investing into these paradigms that they're not even aware of, I think a lot of them are going to get absolutely, absolutely crucified. You take a look at some, in the same presentation, take a look at some of the dot plots going on here. I'm just trying to get back to this. And actually, you know what, we might as well start here too. So this is a chart where it shows what the forward 10-year returns look like when you're in, based upon PE ratios. So when the PE ratios are in, I guess the quick skip to the end version is where they are right now, you know, in the fifth quintile of being as expensive as possible, the forward 10-year returns only 4%. And, you know, which for a lot of people, it's almost like better just to kind of, you know, wait it out, or, you know, not. And what that means is usually there's one big crash, then you've got to then make your way back up from there. But if we take a look at these dot plots, and for people out there who are listening, the dot plots are the Federal Reserve governor's estimate of where they think rates will be in the future. And they're the ones who are actually decide this. So I'm trying to interpret the BS that they are giving us to begin with, because you act of 2012, and they were saying that by 2015, we would be at about 4.25% right now. And now we're at 2.25%. And it's just absolutely crazy. Go to 2014. They said by 2017, we'd be at roughly, you know, call it 3.75%, just eyeballing. Then you go to 2016, they're like, okay, you know, we'll probably be a little bit over three. And then you go to the dot plots that came out a few days ago, and it's absolutely anemic, where it shows, you know, okay, we're going to have a couple rate hikes next year, and then it's going to be flat, and then even going down into 2022. So obviously, you know, what happened? It's been 10 years, and now we're at half of what you thought you would have been, you know, 5 years ago. And this is not, and so the fact that Wall Street and I've had opportunities to talk with different, you know, fund managers and people managing like $1 billion when I was at different firms that I was with. And they would listen to all this and be like, yeah, I agree with you and everything, but, you know, we don't get paid to, you know, if we start saying how bad everything is, you know, we'll get fired. So we can't really, so we agree with you, but, you know, as long as everybody else doesn't realize this, then we're going to go along to get along, you know, with the party. And that's, you know, part of the reason why we're in so much mess is everybody's out there to just go along to get along. But, you know, another thing that you've covered a lot has been the bond market. And with the bond market, we're starting to see, and you know what? You know what? I'll break the rules. I will give financial advice. Do not buy a 30-year bond or even a 10-year bond. You're absolutely crazy if you do that. I mean, I'm not looking at it right now, but what was like the 10 years, like 2.7 and the 1 year is like 2.64 or something like that, at least in the American bonds. Like why would you expose yourself to all that extra interest rate? Because what happens is you got $1 million in a 10-year bond and rates go up 1%, boom, you've got $900,000. You know, you just safely, you know, lost $100,000 of your principal. But I mean, you're still getting your $20,000 a year to live off of. But if you need $40,000 to live off of, now you got to dip into principal and you're never coming back from that, at least in my opinion. So what can you tell us what's going on in the bond market? It seems like, you know, with the inversion that's, you know, starting to occur, that's always usually a bad sign. And it's just crazy how, you know, just, you know, 3 months ago, everything was the greatest economy in the history of the world. And now, you know, most US CFOs think we're going to have a recession in the next year or two, which is a video that you guys did recently on World Alternative Media. So definitely check them out. But what can you tell us about what's going on in the bond market?
Well, what's going on in the bond market is just the prelims of what's going to happen to the monetary system. It's just way too much debt, unsustainable debt all across the world. And, you know, it's interesting when you look at bonds. I just got to mention, you were mentioning who wants to invest in 30-year bonds, but who wants to invest? Like Argentina just recently put out a 100-year bond. Who wants to even, like, what's the point even of investing in a 100-year bond? Like your money's tied up for 100 years and you are investing with an economy, Argentina, like currently has an inflation of 48% and an interest rate, I believe, of 50-something percent. But not only that, they have a terrible track record. They have 6 devaluations and about 6 hyperinflations over the last 100 years of Bank of Argentina. So it's just not a very good, not a very good investment. And of course, it's my opinion, but like common sense would tell you that, like, that's just insane behavior of actually putting your money in that. But the thing is, though, a lot of these pension funds, and you were talking about all the fund manager, they are piling into all this debt that somebody has to buy it. You know, the United States is what is it now? Like $850 billion deficit currently. All of that money has to be bought by someone.
It was like $200 billion just last month, I think, which actually my wife at one point is like, why are you laughing? I'm like, you know, of course, if you're an economic geek like me, I was like, listen, you don't want to know. Like, and she's like, no, really, what, tell me what are you laughing at? I'm like, well, the US just posted a $205 billion deficit for November. And so, I mean, so guys like you and me, we think that's, you know, it's just almost like this gallows humor of like, not like I'm cheering, you know, the destruction of what's going on. I mean, I guess I am cheering the destruction of the monetary system because, you know, the current system is absolute slavery. But yeah, $205 billion deficit for November. So this is a hell of a way to start off, you know, the new fiscal year. Or what was, I guess it started in October, and that was probably another $100 billion too. And I also flashed up where Mnuchin and Trump, before they took office, we're talking about having 50 and 100 year bonds, which was actually in my Trump Effect presentation that I gave. And not only did they not issue 50 and 100 year bonds, they actually then have actually shortened up the amount of bonds that they hold because they realize it's all just, you know, an absolute Ponzi scheme. And what's good for the average consumer saving money and investing is actually bad for, you know, the government because it's all predicated on getting more and more deeper in the debt. And we're all basically slaves right now. So yeah, I'll say it in some gallows humor. But sorry for interrupting. It's just
no worries at all. No, that's what we are. We're just a bunch of slaves. And also to go back to the yield curve you're talking about, you know, when you are investing in something and you're actually investing over the long term, if you're a lender and you're borrowing your money to, you're lending out money to someone, and you're lending it, let's say, you know, five, you're asking for, I'm going to borrow, lend it to you for 5, 10, 30, or 50 years. Well, I want a lot more interest on those longer years because there's so much more risk of lending you money over a further time frame because your exit strategy is kind of limited as well to that, of course. You got to wait a long time and you want more for your money if you put that amount of risk into, you know, trusting somebody for that long to get actually your principal back. So that is another insane thing where you have actually with the yield curve inversion, you have the longer, some of the longer terms are lower than the shorter terms. And that doesn't make sense at all when it comes to just a business model of, you know, bank lending up money as well. It's just completely insane. And then you go and take a look around the world when it comes to the bonds, especially the United States bonds. You have in several countries around the world now, selling off their bonds because they are afraid of what's happening with the United States. The United States is, you know, the backbone. The Fed is the backbone of the world economy. They are the driving force of everything that's happening. And when the World Reserve U.S. dollar is starting to lose trust, which is what you're seeing now with people offloading U.S. bonds like China, like Japan, and a wide array of other countries that are, well, Russia has basically sold everything. You're seeing that they're offloading all their risk because they're seeing what's going to happen eventually with the United States. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a debt default. You could just have people stopping to trust the value of the United States dollar, the US dollar, or the Canadian dollar, any currency. Look at Venezuela, what's happened there. It's more of the people stopped also losing, you know, the belief that the bolivar had value. So they stopped using it. And that's when the government just panics because if they stop using it, they can't tax people anymore. They can't have the perpetual system of unlimited amounts of debt getting printed into the system. And if nobody's borrowing it anymore, you can't have that inflation that you need constantly to keep the system alive. So what you're seeing is, you see a collapse because the government has to print mass amounts of money. Look at Venezuela. It's several things. Of course, the oil price dropped and their 95% of their budget income was oil. So that was another one big thing. But you got to remember when you print too much money as a government like that, because you were so dependent, there's going to be ramifications to that. And look at Venezuela. There's no way back for the bolivar ever to come back. Well, they might revalue it or devalue it in some weird kind of form over time. But I don't think like people have seen enough in Venezuela that they won't trust it over the next, you know, 20 to 30 years. It usually takes two generations to build the trust in a fiat system. And then over that time, suddenly people are experiencing all the troubles and tremors that's happening. Look at 71, right? That's about 40 something years. We're looking at two generations already, and now we're seeing all the ramifications of this money printing that we never learned. Like in year 1024, the Song Dynasty in China invented paper money and did exactly, well, not exactly because they didn't have the technical advantage that we have now, but they did exactly the same thing. They printed mass amounts of money, they created a credit system, and they had a massive economic boom at the time, but then they collapsed their empire collapsed with the value of the currency. And that's what you're seeing in the United States is exactly, you know, following the same steps as that. And then, you know, 2,000 years before that, we had the Roman Empire. They just did it a little bit differently. They debased their currency where they took out, you know, precious metals out of the currencies and put it, replaced it with worse ones. They'd done it in Canada and the United
States. They did it differently. They had living people on their money instead of dead people. So we're like, oh, that didn't work with living people, living clowns on your money. No. Let's just put dead people.
It's better to blame those old guys. Yeah. It's their fault. but that's what it is. It's just the system itself is just built as a Ponzi scheme, as we were saying. And that's how it is. There's no other way of describing the system to me, like saying that it's a Ponzi scheme, because you constantly need more dupes in at the bottom to get into debt in order to pay off the current mass amounts of interest that you have to pay on. So there's no way out of this. We're just going to keep on printing. But at one point, the people are going to say, hey, I don't want that currency anymore. I'm going to go to gold or silver or cryptocurrency, whatever they find that has a better valuation and that could easily be more adaptable to be any form of medium of exchange to preserve their value. That's what they will go to. They won't have any fake fiat Ponzi scheme dollars or krona or whatever currency it is.
Yeah, and it's funny that a lot of this is actually can be boiled down to a meme that I see going around where it's like, it was one of these memes, it said something to the effect of, the government's going to be bankrupt government's going to run out of money Friday unless we pass this bill. And they're like, well, I'm no financial genius, but, I'd say if you're you ran out of money $22 trillion ago. But, when they got out the gold standard in 71 officially, then at that point, they could just inflate things away, and we could be entering new paradigms quickly. And I think that as we enter these new paradigms, it's important that people like you, myself, and a lot of other people in this liberty sphere out here are letting people know, like, don't go toward the Ripple coins, don't go towards, whatever government fiat sanctioned crypto they're going to have. Because, in Venezuela, it's like, oh, well, how we can solve our problem, in air quotes, is we'll just convert all the government pensions into the petro. When the petro is just a cryptocurrency, not that this is going to be a crypto show, but it's going to be a cryptocurrency where the only thing you can do with it is pay your taxes. And finally, there's a crypto that can make Ripple look good out there. So they've done a really good job of doing that. And then also, the ramifications when you have interest rates going up, and then all of a sudden you've got central banks that have $4 trillion worth of bonds on the balance sheet. And this was a question that I posed to one of the Phoenix has a bunch of congressmen out here. There's like more congressmen of Phoenix than the entire state of Wyoming. And so one of the congressmen out here, David Schweiker, who's also in the congressional blockchain. But he said a few years ago, he's like, hey, I've got a chance to ask Janet Yellen a question. Anyone have a question? They happened to pick my question, which was a complete ball buster of a question, which it would take a while to lead up to it. So, and I knew that Schweiker was actually one of the only people smart enough to understand what I was saying. But basically, I was like, well, if you guys say that the interest rates are eventually going to go up and that the economy is going to be doing so great, or we're looking at your dot plots, what happens when the rates do go up? And now all of a sudden you're collecting, from the bonds you already sold, you're collecting, let's say, 0.5% or 1% in interest. Now you're paying the banks out 2%. You're going to be losing 1% off each of those transactions. And then what's going to happen is, right now, traditionally, the Fed gives back 94% of the profit, which is a nice way of saying they take 6% off the top. But when they take 94% of the profit, I'm like, well, what happens when there's not going to be any more profit? You're going to have to actually issue the Treasury like a bill, like, hey, actually, you guys owe us money. And then also what's going to happen is the interest rate, when the interest rates do go up, like they say you guys are going to, like you guys actually say they're going to go up. So if they only go up to what you say they're going to go up, then the underlying balance sheet will actually plummet in value. And then now the assets rolling off will be, you're going to be losing your ass on this. And actually Peter Schiff then did a whole episode based off my question, or a half an episode, but he's like, no, it's a pretty boring day except for this one question. And her response to my question was that my scenario was impossible to actually unfold. I'm like, impossible? I'm like, an alien attack tomorrow could be possible. And I'm like, not only is this not like impossible, this is the actual trajectory that's unavoidable at this moment. But their job is to be cheerleaders. And I believe it was Bob Stanley, who I know you guys are friends with, the other day posted something that said something to the effect of, when's the last time a Fed president warned of an impending crash? And he was talking about, who was it? The maestro, Alan Greenspan.
Janet Yellen.
And he's talking about, that's where I was going with this. He talked about Alan Greenspan. And I go, well, the last time would be about 7 days ago when Janet Yellen said the same thing. So the fact that you've got, all the rats now who are out there trying to protect themselves when she didn't, predict anything. It's just such a predictable situation that's going up and that's going on. And, really appreciate your time today. And I'm sure we could probably keep going on for about another 5 hours of stuff that, I literally have got like 50 articles in a in Evernote that I didn't even look at one of them right now to do this, because it's just overwhelming for people that saw this coming a mile away. None of this is really news to me. None of this is news to you. But keep up the good work out there, and thank you for coming on the show and getting people informed about what's going on. And what's the best place for someone to find you? Is it World Alternative Media YouTube page?
Yeah, definitely. If I can just put in one last little thing.
Absolutely.
Go and look at the stock markets worldwide. And you actually take a look at their yearly returns. There's almost, I believe.
Actually, I have it. Actually, I've got it on another screen that I can get up here in like 2 seconds. All right, boom. Worldwide stock market. Got it on the screen.
Yeah, and what's funny is I would say about 5%, maybe a little bit more, 6% is in the positive. The rest is anywhere from 5 to 25% down this year. And nobody's really talking about that. You don't hear that a lot in media. There's not a lot of people talking about the stock collapse in places like China, for example, which is massive. Like, they have a huge debt over there in China. They kind of gone on steroids trying to replicate and become the U.S. empire in, you know, a decade or so.
Almost 23% down this year. But then, yeah, exactly. Then Trump wants to say we're winning the trade war, yet we have a record amount of trade deficit with China. So depending on how, you know, you define winning, I mean, if winning is all of a sudden now you're, you know, losing more than ever, then I guess in that inverted reality, I guess you're winning. But yeah, I mean, it's just an absolute sea of red, like negative 8, negative 8, negative 22, 20, negative 23. If you only got a few, I mean, it's actually, it's very easy if I just go through and name the only positive ones. It would be a much quicker way to do this.
Yeah, actually, yeah. Russia is one of them.
Which, you know, Jim, I know Jim Rogers is a big contrarian investor, and I know he's been in Russia. So you've got India is up 7.1%, New Zealand 4.3%, Hungary 1.5%, Norway actually looks like that's actually up 2.5%, Brazil 12.1%, Israel 3.3%, and every other country in the world is negative. So there you go. There's the really quick economic report. And we didn't even get into, you know, when the Federal Reserve raises rates, it makes our debt, makes other countries who lend money. Yeah. And we didn't even get into that. So I don't know if you want to touch on what happens to all these foreign countries when they are lending, when they're lending money based in dollars and they see their currency go down relative to the dollar. And then the so people want to blame all these other countries. Well, you know, having the Fed raise rates is not like we live in this vacuum of, you know, it doesn't affect the rest of the world. So things that we're doing directly affects the rest of the world. And this whole race to the bottom of everybody printing money ultimately was going to have to end. And right now, yeah, it ended, you know, I thought it was going to be around 2015, you know, and then Trump getting elected certainly, you know, postponed it. But unfortunately, I wanted him to be able to pick up the pieces, not have Hillary pick up the pieces. And what's probably going to happen is now a Democrat win 2020 and we just delayed everything 4 years and they'll pick up the pieces because all the always Trumpers, you know, weren't sophisticated enough to figure this stuff out. And they should be listening to you and they should be listening to me. But unfortunately, they're calling us liberals. Even though we're classical liberals and
yeah, exactly. That's what I was going to make the point of. It's actually classical liberalism. So yeah, I guess you are a liberal in that term.
Sense. Yeah.
But anyways, no, talking about the extent markets, sorry, the emerging markets, you actually look at Turkey, you know, Indonesia, India, like a whole bunch of other countries that are borrowing money in US debt because the US banking system is borrowing so much money. I have actually a chart of all the different debts around the world from banks in different countries, and their counterparty in most countries is actually the United States banks. That is their biggest where they borrow the most money from. So you're actually seeing that the United States, when they raise the interest rates, they raise the interest rates on everyone. And when that happens also is that there a lot of currencies are fluctuating and then suddenly the currencies lose value to the US dollar as well. And that's when that happens, it becomes so much more expensive for these countries like Turkey, like Venezuela actually, of course, has about $48 billion worth of US dollars through Citibank is their biggest lender. So you're seeing all these countries, they're really struggling because their currencies are really high inflation. Right now, but the problem is that they have to pay back the same amount of debt, and when debt you have a deflation, debt becomes more expensive. When you have an inflation, that debt becomes cheaper. So with a deflation in value for the other currencies to the US dollar, it becomes so much more expensive for them to pay, and the likelihood of a default on that debt becomes very substantial. Look at Venezuela. You know, Obama actually, back in the time, he put out the executive order making Venezuela a threat to the U.S. government. And I believe he didn't say that in the executive order, but the major threat is especially Citibank, which is the major lender to Venezuela, that is, you know, really struggling on actually obtaining. I saw that Venezuela actually recently just defaulted on $1.5 billion of debt, and there's somebody trying to, you know, pick up the pieces like, hey, Venezuela got lots of resources. I guess it comes down to all this lending around the world. You know, it happens when you get the bailouts from the ECB, they're saying, to all these southern European countries, all of them come from banks. You got to remember, like, all of these banks, like Deutsche Bank, Societe Generale, Citibank, and all these countries are actually, they're using the law, the actual commercial banks to bail out. It's not like the ECB writes a check and sends that. It's actually the local commercial banks that are borrowing mass amounts of money out to these countries to bail out the institutions in those countries. And now those countries are under risk. Look at Deutsche Bank, for example, Commerce Bank, like all of these
Santander
banks in Europe. They are in huge collapsed territory right now, their stocks. And of course, you know, sitting on mass amounts of debt to borrowers that can't pay them, like Greece, Spain, Italy, Ireland, and a whole wide array of others. All of these people, they can't pay their money back. But they, like, how are they going to keep the system going? You know, you just got to print more money. That's the thing. And you're going to see this continuing like for as long as possible. Because if you go back to when Ben Bernanke was put in as Fed governor, he wasn't the actual head governor. He was a governor on the board of the Federal Reserve. He had a speech in 2002 saying that we're in uncharted territory, and we might be looking at, you know, looking at the actual type of asset that we'd be buying to become different. So that just tells you that he's looking at, you know, buying stocks, bonds, ETFs, whatever you could get your hand on to prop up this dying fiat currency fractional reserve banking system in order to actually keep it afloat. And that's what you get, what Bank of Japan have done. They're in the massive demographic cliff, talking about demographic cliffs over there. And their markets is not up from the 90s. They're actually quite far down from the 90s, and they're never going to recover. But they've been printing mass amounts of money, buying up all the assets. I believe that's what we're going to see next across the world. More asset buying. I think we're going to get actually more into assets that we know more about, like stocks, bonds, ETFs, mutual funds, whatever they can get their hands on to try to prop up this market. I think that's what's going to happen. I wrote an article back in about year and a half ago where I said the Fed will own everything, then nothing. And I think that's where we're gonna go. That's at least from, like, listen to the guys like Ben Bernanke and others that are in control of the system. That's their belief system, that we're gonna print as much money as possible to save the system, and then we're gonna buy as much assets necessary to keep it afloat.
Yeah, and there is that famous quote that says, you know, first by inflation, then by deflation, we'll end up homeless on the continent our forefathers conquered if we ever allow a private central bank to issue the currency and credit of our nation. I think that was Thomas Jefferson. I was also trying to pull up that article you had with Bernanke in here. It was a kind of large article. And then I also pulled up a tweet from that I remembered from Michael Moore, where Michael Moore go in 2013 said, Hugo Chavez declared the oil belonged to the people. He used the oil to eliminate 75% of extreme poverty, provide free health care and education for all. So obviously that tweet did not age very well, as it's only been 5 years, but, you know, who,
yeah.
And it's funny that Facebook allowed, when I captured that and then I shared that one actually went really viral. So they probably thought it was like a pro Michael Moore thing. So that, like, it somehow escaped all their
yeah, the algorithm didn't actually see what the context of the actual message was.
Yeah, so I guess you have to get more creative in how to get in how to get some of this stuff out. But it's just, yeah, it's just absolutely mind-boggling that we've even been able to even make it to this point so far. We just, I mean, you have to get deeper and deeper into debt to keep this going, and to see people you know, unfortunately, it's like the they, them, those are so great at seeing these movements and hijacking it, where it's like, you know, the yellow vest crowd seem like, you know, they have a lot of good things going, and then somehow somebody gets to the front of the parade and says, you know, actually the real problem is, you know, we need you know, democratic socialism and free stuff, and somehow all these movements get hijacked, just like the Tea Party was hijacked you know, by like the Fox News crowd, you know, several years ago. And now, you get, you know, the Trump supporters who are saying, you know, oh, well, the bump stock, that, you know, that's perfectly reasonable. Nobody uses that anyways. And you guys are just liberals because, you know, you're criticizing Trump. I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm a liberal because I don't want to ban any guns. And Trump has now banned more guns than Obama did. But yeah, so it's just weird dichotomy of when you have when you have this principled, hardcore libertarian position, you know, you're basically, you know, you're not doing your job right if you're not making, you know, people mad on both sides, I guess. But, you know, ultimately, you know, I just want a better world for my kids. And I know that, you know, we're all, you know, they never really ended slavery. They just let us walk around a little bit more. And they found out, you know, with the slaves, they had to pay about 90% of the profit had to go back into keeping the slaves alive, whether it was, you know, feeding them or clothing or shelter. And like, oh, you know, this is a lot of work to only keep 10%. And so maybe we'll let them go run around a little bit more and we'll get higher profit margins because they think that they'll be free. I mean, even the serfs only had to pay 25%. And so it's almost like we'd rather just go back to serfdom, or you might even be able to, and it's just like, you know, slavery ended because it wasn't efficient for the slave owners.
Well, this is a very efficient system. You know, I propose one thing. One of my biggest dreams, actually, and, you know, shouldn't say this out in public because they might come after me, but it's starting.
Well, the last person that said I have a dream out in public was assassinated. So I guess you are not.
Well, I wouldn't mind starting a bank run, to be honest with you. It's as easy as telling people, like, go out and take cash out of your bank, out of your credit unions, and the system will very quickly collapse. I actually, in my speech at Freedom Force International that Ed Griffin's running, I showed a chart, and I could send you that chart, actually. You could get it online. I'll make sure you get it. And it shows all the banks across the world. I did all the major banks and their actual cash to deposit ratios. Now, the problem was a lot of the actual cash is also cash and equivalent. So the equivalent is deposits at the central bank. So that might not necessarily even be cash, but I couldn't, like, some banks show the actual cash. Very few of them did. Most of them show them combined with the actual deposits.
It could be a toxic mortgage that they're, a toxic mortgage that they're saying is, you know, oh, it's good. Don't, you know, trust us.
Yeah. So what was interesting is that these numbers, you know, they range from, actually Deutsche Bank had like something like 30-40% cash, which is pretty interesting. Actually, somebody told me, a banker told me, he tried to tell me off at my post when I said this. It's like, well, we could just sell all the assets. Well, then I said back to him, hey, what if, you know, the US dollar becomes worthless and you can't sell your bonds or whatever you have on your books that you thought you could sell? That's going to be a huge problem for the banks. And, you know, this bank run is as easy for people. Just go out and take your money out of the bank, like the actual physical cash. Don't transfer it over to somewhere else. Actually, people have said to me, oh, we should, I moved my money over to a credit union. And so I had so many people like, hey, you know, can you check out credit unions? And sure enough, I went and checked out credit unions in Canada. Actually, the banks here in Canada is really bad. They're between 5-1% cash to deposit ratios. But the actual credit unions was even worse. There were 3-0.5% cash to deposit ratios. And it makes sense to me because I've heard stories from friends and people that are in the investment field that have tried to take people's money out of the account and actually get cash out. They've said the guy that tried to get $100,000 here tried to get it out of a credit union, and they said, well, it could take up to a year to get you that cash. And that is pretty scary when you hear things like that, because that just tells you how easy it is to topple these banks and why they actually want to go to that cashless system, which would be our ultimate enslavement if they go to that. But that's what they need. They need that, and they need to go to negative interest rates next time, because this time, look at where the interest rates are today. If they were to drop about the same to try to fix the economy as they're trying to manipulate it, they're going to be in negative territory, you know, 2-5%, depending on the country. So there's no way out of this other than them trying to implement their kind of crypto type of currency at a national scale and then, you know, duping people into that. Well, actually, I interviewed a guy called Simon Dixon. He had a very interesting interesting thing to say about this. He said, you know, I have an idea. He said, I think what they might be doing is they might just let all the banks fail, but then they have ready their cashless system, And then say, hey, if you, you know, get your, like, agree to put all your new money into the new system, we'll actually give you all that money in the new system, but now it's completely cashless. And, you know, if you try to get it out of the bank, it's bankrupt, you're not going to get anything. So you might as well come over here and be a complete slave. So that's, I believe that's where they're rolling and going towards, like, that cashless type of system in order to try to save this mass manipulation. Because if we were in the old days, this wouldn't have been gone on for this long. You know, they've been able to manipulate it with the invention of electronic trading and electronic currency. If it wasn't for that, we would have been done way, way a long time ago, because this has been so unsustainable for so long. And I don't see any way out of it, Tim. I think the way out of it's going to be that. But I think there is another side of it, where is our freedom? If we are off the banking grid, you know, move assets into other things. This is, of course, my opinion again. But if you get off the bankster grid and get into assets that are off, you know, the electronic control system that they currently have, you can go into cryptos. You could have precious metals. They don't have full control over that. That is a medium of exchange that could save you in a crisis, in my point of view. I don't know what you think.
You don't even need to have like 100% of your money into any one of these, because in this type of crisis, you could have, you know, 2.5%, and all of a sudden it becomes more than the rest of your 98%, because
100%. Yeah, you're totally right, and that's the thing. People think that, oh, I gotta move all my money over. You know, people panic. It's like, no, you can even like move 5% over. And during a crisis, 5% is way, way, way better than losing 100% of your money.
Absolutely, and I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to talk about at Anarchapoco this year, because, you know, because part of me is like, oh, you know, I can make it on, you know, the impending collapse. I'm like, all right, it might already have collapsed by the time I get there. So I don't know if it might already be all old information. So I think I'm going to talk about different retirement risks that are out there, I know it's a super sexy subject, but, you know, you've got, you know, different inflation risk, deflation risk, withdrawal rate risk, sequence of return rate risk. The longer you live, it increases all those other risks, you know, market crashes, demographics, and I'm not looking at any notes saying this, but it's and I'm trying to just let people know how they can protect themselves given all these different things that could happen, because nobody knows. Because absent central banking, I think it'd be pretty easy to predict what's going to go on. But given that there is central banking and manipulation, you know, the stock market could go to, the Dow could go to 100,000, because all of a sudden tomorrow we're going to print, you know, trillions of dollars. So, you know, there is no sponsors for this show, but I will give, you know, a quick plug that, you know, what we've been doing, we started doing it several months ago. We got our clients where we used a small amount of their portfolio, put it into put options, which increased in value as these markets were going down. So it's sort of like you buy, you know, you pay for homeowners insurance, your house burns down, you get your house built back. But, you know, if your house doesn't burn down, then you lose the insurance. What we've seen this past like 2-3 months, those put options have gone up, and so depending on which ones, you know, 100%, 200%, just crazy amounts. But we used a small percentage of the portfolio to then hedge the rest of their portfolio, where there was a finite a quantitative amount that they could go down. But also the reason why we didn't, you know, go full all in on that strategy was because, you know, if the government then says, hey, we're going to print $10 trillion tomorrow and the markets go up 200%, well, then we own the underlying index, and now you're out the price of the insurance premium. And just, you know, and I don't, you know, want to be some guy that's seen out here shilling or doing some other stuff, but because, you know, I didn't shill hard enough, you know, 3 months ago when I put out a video the day the market started going down that I made 2 days before it started going down, you know, to get into that strategy now is, now, since I mentioned it went up 100%, some of them are up 200%, it means it costs over twice as much to do this strategy now. So, you know, I should have been shilling harder, because, you know, in order to protect people, you know, there's a lot of different ways that we can do this. And if you guys want to know more about this, you can go to, you know, see me speak at the Dollar Vigilante Summit. And I know that you guys are going to be there covering all that. And then one other important thing I want to mention here is, you guys, you had mentioned that, you know, having this bank run, and I'm actually a big runner and triathlete. So I was thinking, well, you know, do I have like a 5K? It's like the 5K bank run. And so maybe we start.
That would be fun. We should do something like that.
Maybe we have like an annual like Federal Reserve run where we have like the bank run. And some annual thing that, or maybe we could go to all the cities where the feds have different, you know, satellite offices.
Yeah, and it should end at the actual bank. That'd be actually, that's a fantastic idea. I think if there's somebody out there that's willing to organize that, like, go and do it. I might consider doing that here in my local town, doing a bank run. And I think that would be hilarious. And it would actually, you know, bring bring it out to people that, and kind of educate them during that period of, you know, raising money to like maybe a charity or something. I don't care, but something good, you know, and then we have a bank run. I think that's a genius idea.
Maybe donate it to like the Mises Institute or something to teach people, you know, actual real, you know, real economics of what's going on. And one thing I saw that Trace Mayer, who's, you know, old time crypto OG, who told basically, you know, I think he gave, you know, Berwick one of his first Bitcoins, and Doug Casey, and all, a lot of the, you know, he was one of the first guys talking about Bitcoin way back early on, but he is coming out with an initiative called Proof of Keys to celebrate the Genesis block of Bitcoin, which was January 3rd. So January 3rd, he's saying everyone should take their crypto off the exchanges via, you know, sort of like a stress test. And he's like, if you own Bitcoin, and this will just
make it
stronger. And so then you go with, you know, it parlays exactly what you're talking about, you know, having the proof of ownership, except with cryptos, there's probably a lot more likelihood that most of the exchanges are on the up and up. And maybe there's only a few that won't have your money, but you know, it's a good, but ultimately you want to hold on to your private keys, not to make this a, you know, a crypto podcast, but it goes along with proof of keys versus proof of funds. We know that the funds aren't actually there. So, you know, and so unfortunately, you know, I have some clients who are like, you know, I want to keep my money safe. You know, some of my clients have sold their houses recently and are renting, and they're like, well, you know, I want a no risk investment because I want to buy a house in a year or two. And it's like, well, you know, it's really tricky because yeah, there are some risk in money markets. There's risk in, you know, there's risk all the way around. And so you're
Proof of ownership is so important in any asset that you have. If you can't, like, if it's a risk of the actual ownership and losing it, you know, in crises, then, you know, it's not really yours. Like, you got to make sure, like, I'm a very conservative, super conservative investor. I like to have my assets, as many of them as I can, in my physical ownership, because I know the risks involved. If you get asset freezes in the markets and so on during a crisis, you're not going to have access to those things.
So John's coming to us from a hidden bunker up there in Canada. So we'll not be giving his address over there. But no, I definitely appreciate your time. I know that we could keep, you know, dovetailing this into other things. And yesterday on Ernest Hancock's show, he had Doug Casey on. And then when you have this everything bubble that's going on, he said, you know, sometimes you just want to be, you know, when every asset class is overvalued, sometimes you just want to be the guy that's maybe only down 5%, and then that way you can go pile into something else when it's down, you know, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90%. And then when during these extreme periods of overvaluation, that, you know, a lot of money's to be made, and the real money elite, they're not, you know, out there crying and, you know, worrying about all this stuff. You know, they've already sold, you know, the time to panic is before everybody else panics. And it's during these panics is when you make a whole bunch of money. And being in the epicenter of, you know, the real estate market and, you know, the crash that happened in America, I mean, I think Josh is in the other Mecca, was, you know, Phoenix and Vegas, probably the two hardest hit places. I have clients who bought houses in 2006 who are just now coming out from being
recovering.
I've got, and I mentioned I'm in a rental home. There was a house across the street from me that's for sale that I think in 2000, and I think it was in 2006, sold for like $380,000, and now they can't even sell it for like $290,000, and it's 12 years later, almost 13 years later. And then the house right next to that, I mean, similar situation. Luckily, they bought it in 08, so they bought it for like $350,000, and now they're trying to sell it for, you know, $350,000 or $360,000. Yeah. But, you know, but there's different costs in there. And so my wife's all hung up on like, oh, you know, only poor people rent. And I'm like, you know, that's BS. And like, what if we go and we spend, you know, $500,000 on the house tomorrow, and then, you know, 2 years later, it's worth $300,000.
Now we've got negative equity. Yeah,
exactly. Now we've got a negative $200,000. So it's so the net worth is actually more important than, you know, how much money you make or all this other stuff. And then it limits your freedom. Cause then if you don't have the money to pony up or don't want to declare bankruptcy or short sale, then you've got to, then you're forced to live there. And yeah, there's reasons of why you'd want to be in a house or not. I'm not giving advice that everyone goes and sells their house tomorrow and goes and rent. But if you're in a house where you know that you don't want to be in there for the next, you know, 5, 6, 7 years, which the house I was in before backed up to a busier road, and I bought in within a month of the market low, in 2012, and then, you know, then sold my house in July. So I mean, I could have potentially timed that bottom and the high in this, but unfortunately, a lot of the money had to be used in order to create this company over here when the government decided to shut me down after Anarchapoco. But not to shut me down, I voluntarily resigned, and then they wouldn't approve my paperwork for 6 months. So I didn't get shut down.
it sounds a lot like actually what a financial advisor that I wrote in my book. He wants to be he doesn't want his name out there because he would definitely lose his license with the ideas that he's talking about. So it's just like, yeah, securities is created like a prison of like cultural Marxism where you can't talk about certain aspects of your of what is actually going on. And it's just a propaganda machine, basically, that is run by these institutions that has been created by the banks, you know, to control what's coming out of, you know, those peasants running around and giving advice.
Yeah, I know. It's a crazy situation we're in. But, you know, we'd love to have you back on the show sometime, and I'd be happy to go back in your
time.
Provided, you know, wonderful information for everybody. And until next time, we'll talk to you guys later.